I'm sure most people outside of Jamaica don't remember that a massacre happened there on May 24, 2010. At least 73 civilians were killed in a raid that followed a request by the United States for the extradition of Christopher Koch, a notorious drug lord. But Mattathias Schwartz's exhaustive piece in the December 12th issue of The New Yorker explains why you should care about what happened. I'm pleased to welcome Mattathias Schwartz to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thank you.
When did you first hear about the massacre and how?
I actually went to Jamaica for fun, just for vacation. And then I just started talking to people on the street in Kingston. And everyone there seemed to have this version of what happened that differed significantly from what we'd heard in the news.
And this was a big deal in Jamaica?
Oh, yes. This was on the front page of every Jamaican daily newspaper. I think all three or four of them for 4 or 5 months.
And what about now? Is it still being discussed a year and a half later?
There's actually a story in today's Jamaica Gleaner that's based on my story from The New Yorker, where they report this new information that's in my story about the May 2010 massacre.
Oh, I don't know what the situation is in Jamaica, how open people feel about talking to strangers. Did you have any problem getting people to tell you what happened?
Yeah, it was very difficult, particularly speaking to police and to military folks who were there. I actually wasn't able to do that. When Cy Hirsch reported on Mili, and when Mark Danner did a great piece on a big massacre that occurred during the Cold War in El Salvador, they were able to talk to the soldiers who were involved. And this, it only being 1 year later, it was much more difficult.
How long did you spend there, all told?
11 weeks, and then I actually spent 2 weeks living in the neighborhood itself of Tivoli Gardens.
Was Christopher, what is his nickname, Dudas?
Yeah, Dudas. I was told that that's like a play on Douglas, because he used to dress like this guy Douglas when he was a kid.
Well, Christopher Dudas Koch, was he the top drug don in Jamaica?
That's what everyone says, and some people say he was the most powerful man in Jamaica. Some people say he was even more powerful than the prime minister at the time, named Bruce Golding, who's since resigned partly because of this. And if you look at the extent to which the prime minister of Jamaica, Bruce Golding, resisted the United States attempts and request to extradite Koch, it does look like Koch was very powerful, maybe even more powerful than the prime minister himself.
Was it because he was just such a powerful drug lord, or because he also had established himself as a community leader?
Well, politics in Jamaica don't really work like politics here. I think another writer said it's as though the Crips had aligned with the GOP and the Bloods had, you know, were Democrats. And you have these this two-party system and alliances between street gangs. And then you have these local figures called dons, who are almost like warlords. They disperse government contracts and money. They control the transshipment of drugs into the United States. And they're also, you know, deeply, deeply involved with the nation's political system. You know, they push their own candidates, and they decide who ultimately, you know, they control votes by dispersing housing in their neighborhoods.
They also maintain law and order in their neighborhoods, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They have
people
their own...
are afraid to commit robberies.
Yeah, no. I talk about this in the piece. You know, there was a minister in Tivoli Gardens who told me that, like, if you go to the police, if you something's taken from you and you go to the police, you know, nothing will happen. They take a statement and that's it. But if you go to if you know someone who's connected to the president, which is what they called Koch, you know, they'll have your thing back in a day. They just have to ask someone who had responsibility for that area.
He is the son of Lester Lloyd Koch, who was also a famous don, even more famous than he?
Arguably. I mean, it remains to be seen. But Lester Lloyd Koch, also known as Jim Brown.
Why Jim Brown? Did he look like Jim Brown, the football player?
I think he saw the movie, The Dirty Dozen, about the prisoned, hardened Nazi hunters, and then was so moved by that he began to call himself after, you know, Jim Brown, who played a tough guy in this movie. You know, it's amazing how much Hollywood culture and American popular culture, you know, when exported, really gets taken on by criminals in other countries. I mean, I had folks there quoting Scarface to me. It's almost like Hollywood, in some ways, has provided the model.
So did Jim Brown establish some of the things that his son later did? For example, no one paid for electricity in Tivoli.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's only 3 million people on the entire island of Jamaica. So it's smaller, say, than Philadelphia. So it's almost like, imagine you take Philadelphia, which for years has had a very corrupt local government, You know, I lived there for a while and got rid of the federal government, got rid of the FBI, put all of Philly on an island for you know, two or three decades. You know, you would see a lot of connections and links and associations between the political world and the underworld that would just never fly here in the U.S.
Well, how would you describe Tivoli Gardens? What part of Kingston is it in?
Well, it's down by the bay, and people will tell you not to go there. And it's a mixture of bungalows, four or five story sort of low high-rise apartment buildings, and then two and three story row houses. It's important to note that I went there after Koch had left, so it still wasn't under his authority. It wasn't under his authority anymore.
Did another Don take over?
No. While I was there, it was under the control of the military and the police. It was almost like, almost looked like in some ways, like you might imagine an occupied country. You had soldiers with M16s, you know, walking through, you know, kids playing soccer games. It's the kind of image you might imagine seeing in like, in, you know, the occupied areas of Palestine or something. Now, I've been told that the army has since left. It's only the army who's told me that. It hasn't been confirmed.
But is it ironic that this neighborhood, Tivoli Gardens, was designed as a way of getting rid of slums? The American-born, Harvard-educated sociologist Edward Ciaga is the designer, and he said once, "We have not only taken the man out of the slum, but we have taken the slum out of the man."
And that's exactly the
opposite. So had this place become a slum?
That's exactly the opposite of what happened. It became the first of Jamaica's garrison communities where everyone in the neighborhood votes along party lines. I think if you look, I went to Parliament and looked at election results. If you look at the way that Tivoli Gardens votes in elections, it'll sometimes be like 4,200 and something to zero once it was actually, you know, 4,000 and something to nil. So, yeah, there are a lot of ironies here. I mean, you could argue that the United States had a role in creating this whole problem. If you go to Edward Ciaga's office, which I did, you'll see framed letters thanking him for his support of the U.S. government in Jamaica, signed by Ronald Reagan and other really, really top diplomats. And for a long time, Ciaga was seen as our man in Jamaica, holding the line against the other party, the PNP, who were seen as being more aligned with Cuba. And then there's also, you know, Ciaga created the first and most prominent of these garrison communities, and some people say he even had a role in making sure that the dons or these powerful criminal leaders, you know, had access to arms and had access to government contracts and wealth.
Because
and
he saw them as enforcers for his government.
Exactly, they could get out the vote. They could distribute the contracts. They could sort of deal with the end of the line of the water pail of social services. So when you look at someone like Jim Brown, who's Christopher Koch's father, you know, Edward Ciaga, you know, was largely responsible for his rise. I mean, they were perceived as being a team for a while, And then the United States had a lot to do with Ciaga's rise.
I'm talking with Mattathias Schwartz, whose article in the December 12th issue of The New Yorker is A Massacre in Jamaica. Why did the U.S. demand that Christopher Koch be extradited? What kind of evidence did they have to support the request?
It's not clear exactly what evidence they had because he's pled guilty and there's not going to be a trial. We do know
he's pled guilty here.
He's pled guilty in the United States, and he's awaiting sentencing, which is going to happen in early January. But in terms of the evidence they had against him, they had 35,000 wiretapped conversations they've been listening to since 2004. And so, you know, that and they had accused him of trafficking in guns and narcotics and being connected to all kinds of violent acts, both here in the United States and in Jamaica. And it's alleged that usually he acted through proxies and sort of, you know, in spoken code on phones. But whatever they do have against him, it was enough for his attorneys to agree to plead guilty.
Although it took 9 months before they actually staged the raid.
Yeah, 9 months elapsed between the time we officially requested the extradition and the time that the Jamaican government agreed to process it and put out, you know, sign it and put out a warrant for Koch's arrest. And I the perception is that that's because of Koch's influence with the Jamaican government. Although the Jamaican Prime Minister Bruce Golding said, "Well, you know, it's not that; it's an issue of rights and constitutional rights." And so that, you know, that's been his response.
And Tivoli Women organized a march protesting the extradition.
People in the neighborhood were loyal enough to Koch that they held up signs and said, you know, we will die for Dodos. You know, God comes first, president next, things like that. And I think the government at the time, the Jamaican government, made the argument that people were doing this out of fear. If that's true, it was a fear that had been around so long that it had turned to love. During the time that I was there, it really seemed like people in the neighborhood did hold him in high regard, you know, despite all of these violent and criminal acts.
He was giving them all those services, including free electricity.
Yeah, and it's a real desperate situation down there. And people, there's a lot of begging that goes on to survive, and so you cling to what you have.
Now, we hear about drugs coming into this country from Mexico and Colombia. How big a role do the Jamaican dons play in drug trafficking to the United States?
It used to be a much larger role. I 10 or 20 years ago, Jamaica was a key transshipment point for drugs coming up from Colombia, particularly cocaine. Some drugs still make it in, but interdictment efforts have been pretty successful. One number I've heard kicked around by some folks in the Jamaican government that Jamaica has gone down from, you know, being responsible for 20 or 30% of the drugs entering the United States to more like 2 or 3% today.
And that's because Jamaica, at least in the old days, was in a good position. The Colombians could come there, and that would be a halfway point.
You'd have little planes, and you'd have particularly speedboats were a big problem. But my understanding is that the U.S. government was able to cooperate with the Jamaican government and build up their capacity for law enforcement, and that's cut down the flow of drugs. One thing I want to make sure we get to is the role that the United States appears to have had in this incident in Tivoli Gardens that led to the death of these 73 civilians.
Okay, let's get to that. Yeah, okay. Had the police ever had operations in Tivoli before?
It had been 9 or 10 years is what I learned since they've been able to operate in there as a regular police force. There had been a couple of raids that occurred. In one case, I think it was between 5 and 10 people died, and then in 2001, between 20 and 30 people died when a sort of aggressive police commander decided to go in and search for drugs and arms that he said were in the neighborhood, and a lot of people wound up getting shot, and over 15,000 rounds were expended, and there was a parliamentary inquiry. So this had happened before, and a lot of people had died before, but it never quite happened as hard or as violently as this.
Had there been any warning that there'd be that raid in 2010?
In 2010?
Yeah, were people told the cops are going to come in, you should probably leave the area if you have nothing to do with Christopher Koch?
The whole neighborhood was barricaded, and the government, they sent down buses, and they asked people to go on the buses, and they said the buses would take them away to a safe location. But by the time the buses got there, they were parked a long ways away from people's homes. There was intermittent gunfire, and people would have to walk across this open field to get on the buses to take them to a world they didn't even know where. And so very, very few people actually left. And others did not have a place to go.
You tell the story of a couple, Marjorie Hines and Radcliffe Freeman, who's known as Mickey, who lived in an apartment just north of Koch's headquarters. How did you come to hear that story?
I spent many days walking around the neighborhood and talking to different people and trying to get a sense of what had happened and trying to get a sense of who I could really trust, of who was telling me the truth, of whose stories aligned and correlated with other stories. And I heard a lot of stories of innocent people being shot and killed by the police and security forces. Now, innocent is a very difficult word to pin down. It's very, very hard to prove that a person is innocent after they are dead. And this is one reason that extrajudicial killings work, and it's one reason that it's easy to color them one way or the other.
That
is the opposite of what I was saying. The thing that drew me to Mickey and the thing that drew me to Marjorie is that their stories lined up with, you know, stories that I collected from 6 or 7 other people who'd been in the area at the time. The other important thing about Mickey is that he had worked to help build the United States Embassy in Kingston. That is a fact, and it's been confirmed by the embassy. In order to get that job, he had to pass a police background check. They had to check his name against a list of known criminals in Kingston, Jamaica. And I talked to someone, and now, you know, in May 2010, he was shot at least 10 times by the security forces on May 24th, 2010. And those are the facts. So I was drawn to his story because of everyone who died, and there were a lot of them. He was one who his reputation was easier for me to substantiate.
Well, there were also women who died.
There were three women, and there was also a 25-year-old United States citizen named Andre Smith, who was down in Jamaica visiting his great aunt, who appears to have been shot and killed on May 24th, and who also, you know, I tried so hard to find any criminal associations for any of these people. I found almost nothing. And the little scraps I did find are all in the story, and they don't add up to much when you consider the influence that Coke had in the area.
Well, he escaped, didn't he?
This guy who had been perceived as being the neighborhood's protector for well over a decade, as soon as the police came in, he disappeared.
And why were they rounding up all these people? They sent many to detention centers, didn't they?
Yeah, they rounded up everyone in the neighborhood, or most everyone. Most of the men were sent to detention centers. And then, I have all of these very disturbing accounts of young men, of police and soldiers making the decision on the spot who is innocent and who is guilty. And this isn't something that should be decided by police and soldiers. This is something that should be decided by a court. But every indication I have from 11 weeks of reporting in Tivoli Gardens is that that is not how it was decided on May 24, 2010. Now, it's very important to know this. While all of this was going on the day that all of these people, were killed and are alleged to have been killed and some executed by their own police and security forces, there was a surveillance plane being operated by the United States Department of Homeland Security. This has been confirmed to me by the United States government. It was flying above Kingston. It was shooting video of the ground. It was relaying intelligence from that video through U.S. officials to Jamaican officials who were involved with the operation on the ground. This has all been confirmed to me by the State Department. And so I don't know what's on the video. The government's refusing to release it. But it would definitely, it could potentially help us answer some of these questions about exactly what happened.
Does the United States government accept any responsibility for the deaths of these 73 people?
I don't know. Not to me so far. But I think they're still, I know that they're looking at my story now and figuring out how they're going to respond. And we should give them a chance to respond. But looking at the facts as we know them now, it's very easy to see. Looking at all the facts that have been published in the story this week, it's easy to see how the United States could have been inadvertently complicit in the massacre of more than 70 civilians a year ago in Jamaica. And it's interesting that this plane was operated by the Department of Homeland Security. Last time I checked, Jamaica is not a part of the U.S. homeland. So it raises a lot of questions about, what is the outermost limit of U.S. sovereignty, and how, to what extent can we involve ourselves in the doings of police forces and of militaries that may not follow the same kind of human rights standards that our own do?
Wasn't Christopher Coke negotiating his surrender all along? Was it even necessary to raid the neighborhood?
I wasn't there. I don't have a background. I'm not a military person, so I'm unqualified to answer the question of whether it was necessary. They had given him some time to come out. He had definitely fortified the area. In my opinion, based on what I know, he deserves a lot of blame for this. He put his own people between himself and his country's military, and it's hard not to see how he was complicit in all of this too. I'm not going to second guess Commissioner Ellington, who heads the Jamaican police force. I'm not going to second guess what measures might have been necessary to get him or to get him out.
Well, how much has the Jamaican government made public about all of this?
Very, very little. I mean, almost nothing. There've been a couple of statements. The army has been a little bit more forthcoming. They did share a couple of videos with me showing that there were gunmen in the area before they went in. To me, this matter, it's not going to be laid to rest until we hear from the police and the military who were on the ground in Tivoli Gardens on May 24th, and we hear them explain who were these 73 people and how was it that you had 73 civilians die, only, you know, three from the security forces, and with only six guns recovered. I mean, you know, I looked at this for 11 weeks. I talked to everyone I could. I put questions to the army, to the police, to the Jamaican government, to the U.S. government. And in the end, it's pretty clear to me that this was a massacre. And the, you know, the story is called A Massacre in Jamaica. So, you know, the magazine agrees.
And what happened to the bodies?
That's a long story. You know, some of them were taken to a funeral home. Some of them were left out in a cemetery. A lot of them are now in graves that are marked by numbers and metal plates, those that weren't claimed. I mean, I know that they were, the area was called by some Ground Zero, and I talked to one guy who was dealing with the bodies who the notation for the bodies was like Ground Zero 1 and Ground Zero 2. So in the beginning there were so many of them that they weren't even assigned names, they were assigned numbers, and the crime scenes by and large were not preserved. The bodies were immediately picked up, put in trucks, and taken out of the area.
How is Marjorie Hines doing these days? Her husband.
If you look in the story, you'll see she's not doing very good. That's one real challenge of reporting an incident like this is often the people who are hit the hardest are in the sort of least equipped to talk about it because they've been so traumatized. So she used to sell vegetables in the market. Now I think she makes a lot of her income from begging and from handouts from her friends and neighbors. And, you know, I owe her a call, and it's hard for me to know, having lost, the father of her children, what's going to happen to her.
We have a link to the story in The New Yorker on our show page at WNYC.org. The article is called A Massacre in Jamaica. It's in the December 12th issue of The New Yorker. And my great thanks to Mattathias Schwartz, who wrote it, for coming by to talk to us about it on our show.
Thank you, Leonard. It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.